where you live in the Shaky Isle, the sorts of disruption to large-scale grid infrastructure that are possible as a result implies to me distributed energy system with nodes that can operate independent of the grid as the default is absolutely a policy that should be set in stone.
A very big welcome to this episode of Front Footing the Future. I'm Lindsay Wood, the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and I'll be your host for interviewing about 20 experts ahead of the New Zealand general election and exploring how we can make our climate policy fit for purpose. I'm remiss that I hadn't invited today's guest to join me on climate matters well before this. Nathan Surendran has long been an insightful player in the energy and climate field, and he and I have similar orbits that don't intersect as often as I would like. He runs the engineering consultancy Schema, helping clients navigate major uncertainties in energy, resilience, and systems thinking. And he's been more in the spotlight recently as a result of the Strait of Hormuz standoff. Nathan also leads the future-focused organization Wise Response and runs the popular Substack Energy and Resilience. Nathan, I'm so looking forward to at last having a conversation with you. Very warm welcome to Climate Matters.
Thank you, Lindsay, and thank you very much for having me on. We were just discussing in the pre-meeting that we have exchanged a few emails over the years, but yeah, it's great to meet you in person and to be able to have a bit of a conversation around some big topics.
Yes, and I am looking forward to that. Let's start with the big topic, the big energy picture. Although energy is at the heart of everything from a bowl of breakfast cereal to our entire economy, it's almost always spoken of just as a derived demand, as a commodity we call up for whatever purpose we have in mind. Would you please give us a systems thinking overview of the relationship between energy and our society?
Of course. So, in terms of the relationship between energy and our society, the fundamental thing that I want to highlight to people today is that energy is essential to everything that our society has aspirations to do. And often it's invisible. We have lots of energy slaves, which are working away 24/7 for us behind the scenes. And to give you an idea of how many slaves, we can think in terms of the energy in a barrel of oil. It's about 4.5 years of human labor, and we burn through something in the region of 130,000 barrels of oil per day in New Zealand. At that scale, what that means is that that's around about 500,000 years, give or take, of human labor input equivalent to our society per day, just from the oil. And oil is maybe only, let's say 25 to 30% of the total energy that we leverage as a society.
A quick interjection for those listeners who, like me, can't do the mental arithmetic as quickly as Nathan. That number is equivalent to New Zealand having a permanent workforce of over 200 million people, and that is just the contribution of the oil consumption in our little country of 5.5 million people. Back to Nathan.
As I say, people really just need to understand the scale of the advantage that gives us. It is true now that we don't really have any people in our society. My grandparents, who were born, around First World War time, were probably the last generation to have a childhood that wasn't really substantially affected by oil expenditure and the advantages that started to give us through the early part of the 20th century. And so nobody really understands in this society what it's like to live in a society that doesn't have that, unless they've come from some sort of community that specifically eschews the use of oil, or if they've grown up in a different part of the world where the amount of energy that we leverage in New Zealand society just isn't available. An interesting note on that front is when people go to those, and I'm going to call them, you know, people often call it the underdeveloped parts of the world. I would maybe reframe that as, you know, the more frugal parts of the world that use a lot less energy. They say two things, and this is not to, you know, play down the difficulties of living with less energy, but they come back saying two things. They're the poorest people I've ever met in material terms, but they're the happiest people I've ever met. And if you think of it in sort of spiritual or community terms, you know, that they are a lot richer than we are in many respects because of the interdependence that they have within their society, because they can't hold each other at arm's length as a result of the energy that we leverage to do things that we would have had to do collectively were it not for the leveraging of that resource. So it's an interesting tension and dynamic there, and something that will be important to come back to as we go through this chat.
Oh, yes, that's so interesting. And there's a great juxtaposition of being the poorest and the happiest. And I can bear that out from visits I've done, for example, to the Pacific Islands and so on.
Yes.
Another thing that I'm sure we could talk about at length, but it may need to be parked for now, is the whole issue of the shifting baseline, because what you referred to about our grandparents' generations and so on very much illustrate that, don't we? That what we think is the norm now is sort of living like royalty compared with people 100 years ago, sort of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, kings and queens from the sort of Victorian and Georgian eras and so on lived lives that were materially poorer than, you know, people in the lowest 50% deciles in our societies today. It's quite incredible to think how that baseline has shifted.
Yes. And I think let's qualify what I just said. That there's a shift in quantum of energy and so on used, but it hasn't been reflected in improvement in happiness.
That's right. And, you know, there's been some very interesting research around how GDP and energy correlates, and how over a certain level of GDP per capita, you don't get a corresponding increase in happiness.
Yeah, so I was interviewing Shamabil Jacob the other day, and we got talking about Wilkinson and Pickett's well-known book, The Spirit Level. I don't know if you're aware of that, but that very much goes into that territory, doesn't
it? That's right.
Oh, well, here we are. We're still on topic one, Nathan, and we've been down two or three rabbit holes already. I'm so enjoying this. If I may, I'd like to take us into the deep end a bit from here, and that is the question of, I've framed it as getting from here to there, where we are now to where we've got to be. Ongoing systemic failures of societies to effectively decarbonize have resulted in a worsening of the climate crisis and a resultant increase in the scale of necessary adaptation and mitigation. And as if that's not enough, that has also reduced the time available to implement these strategies. How would you encourage listeners to think about the sort of trajectories we might be compelled to follow over the next couple of decades?
So I think you're right to point to the systemic failures. It's really hard to look back to the 1970s. I mean, I was born in 78, so I didn't personally experience that decade, but my parents did. My dad, who was an engineering PhD and thermodynamics professor, he talked about this stuff with me over the years. And what happened in the 70s as a result of the oil crises and the level of understanding of the energy trajectories and the types of adaptation and mitigation that would be needed and so on. I found when I got my head into this topic about 15 years or so ago, a lot of thinking has already been done in that decade. And then, you know, there were the neoliberal reforms of the early 80s and a lot of material abundance narratives that flowed out of that. And people found it very difficult to take the practices that they'd started developing and to run with those. So as a result of that, you know, we haven't had the progress that we should have had in the last 40 years. Looking forwards from where we are now, you know, we can't really see another period like the last 40 years and the next 40 years. And I think that's a really important point to make, is that, you know, when we talk about the trajectories, there is this temptation to backcast and then project forwards in a kind of slightly linear thinking fashion. And when you take a systems approach and you think about the overall complexity of the systems, and you think about some of the limitations, the hard biophysical, geophysical limits that we face as a result of the impacts that we're having on the planetary boundaries, and also the resource depletion situation that we find ourselves in, there are constraints that are going to guide us. And I think it's been interesting during this recent energy crisis to think about global equity in that regard. You know, I was out of the gate at the start of the crisis saying this is a lot more serious than I think a lot of people will have realized at this point. And looking at that, how the global economic system and effectively rationing by price has protected higher income economies like New Zealand from the worst effects. But what that means in practice is that there won't be diesel to run the irrigation pumps in some of the poorer parts of the world that protect their food production. And as a result of that, you know, there will be some quite unpalatable outcomes as a result of the dynamics of that rationing by price approach in those parts of the world.
Can I interrupt briefly, Nathan? Two things I'd like to pick up more on that. But first of all, just to jump back at the start of what you're just saying, you talked about us facing hard biophysical limits. And I wondered if you could just itemize a little bit for listeners that aren't used to thinking in those terms. Could you just spell out a little bit about what you mean by that?
So, as I said, there's two parts to it. There's the planetary boundaries framework that was put out by the Stockholm Resilience Institute, and that's been updated over the years. But basically, it shows that we're surpassing safe thresholds on something like 7 out of 9 boundaries that they've described, and that includes chemical flows, things like nitrogen and phosphorus in particular. It includes novel entities like forever chemicals, and obviously climate change is included in there as one of them. So those are kind of, I guess you'd say, ecological limits. And then there's the sort of geophysical, I guess, physics-based limits around energy supply. And there's a lot of noise in this space, and it is unsurprising that people are confused. I go back to, I guess, the basics on this in my mind, which is that oil is a finite resource. It is effectively the master resource, and particularly diesel, because of it's diesel that does a lot of the heavy lifting in the economy in terms of mining, logistics. And it takes a while to unpick this, but as you look into the numbers around global oil supply, what you can see is that since the great financial crisis of the GFC, and actually slightly before that, there's been this, I guess you'd say, bifurcation where the oil liquid supply has continued to go up when looked at globally, but the diesel fraction of that, and it's actually more than diesel, it's jet fuel as well, what's known as the middle distillates, the kind of medium weight stuff. If you think about oil as a spectrum from tar at the bottom end to LPG at the top end, then you can think about those middle distillates as being the critical ones, and particularly diesel. And the supply of that has kind of plateaued to some degree, and the only growth really in total all liquid supply in the last 15 years has been primarily from the US via the supposed shale revolution. And so that's added a lot of lighter weight oil to the mix, but it has not solved the problem of middle distillates. And that, as a result, we have this, I guess you'd say, simmering crisis, which is that already now in parts of the world, as I mentioned, there are significant diesel shortages. That is both a result of the current Strait of Hormuz crisis, but also a result of that broader trend. And that broader trend is going to continue. If you looked at the IEA World Energy Outlook from 2022, I think it was, they projected that by 2030, by the end of this decade, we produce about 100 million barrels per day of oil globally in round numbers. And they were projecting something in the region of an 18% shortfall of supply relative to demand by that time. So, you know, there is a significant constraint there, which is the oil supply rate cannot keep up with the projected rate of demand increase to support GDP growth, which is, you know, the policy target of corporates and governments alike.
That's a massive shortfall, isn't it? And I think one of the messages inside what you're just saying, Nathan, that I think not everybody realizes is that not all oil wells are made the same. In other words, what you extract from Venezuelan oil might be a very different combination of those distillates you talked about to something extracted from shale oil. Am I in the right territory there?
You are. And, you know, the reality of the US military moves over the last year or so has been that they have attacked Venezuela and Iran, which are two of the largest sources of potential growth in the sorts of heavy oil and sour crude that will be needed to support middle distillate supply volumes in any scenario. So yes, there's some clear linkages there between what's gone on militarily from the US and that situation that we've been describing.
Yes, thank you for that perspective on it. And also picking up on what you're talking about, a diesel shortfall, and particularly the one in the current one as a result of the Strait of Hormuz, I got the sense from what you were saying that, in a way, once again, the poorer countries are liable to suffer because they can't apply the financial leverage to buy what is available. I think you mentioned, for example, irrigation systems in some of the poorer countries. Am I reading you right there that there is an inequity thing coming through in this process?
Absolutely, yeah. I don't know if you picked up on my surname, but my father was Indian from Kerala in southwest India, although he was actually a Malaysian citizen. But I have a whole side of my family who I'm not as connected to as I would like to be, but, you know, representative. I mean, they are pretty highly educated and have done pretty well in many respects. But, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I would like to think of myself as, you know, a global citizen, not just a New Zealand citizen. I'm an immigrant to this country. And when I sit with the reality of that rationing by price mechanism that we discussed before and the implications of that for lower income nations in terms of inequity of supply and so on, I just feel that conversation in New Zealand around the ethics of the position that we've taken in this current crisis, which is basically carry on with business as usual, we'll have to pay a bit more at the pump, oh look, things are kind of settling down, the price is coming back down, well, we kind of got away with it, didn't we, and what was the problem, is absolutely a very blinkered view, and I don't believe it's appropriate for a nation that, you know, I guess aspires to see itself as a good global citizen. That's, of course, an assumption on my part that is, in fact, what New Zealand wants to do. But, my personal feeling is that it's really important to have that discussion about the broader implications beyond the borders of New Zealand of the energy crisis. And, I really wanted to emphasise that point.
Well, that's a point very well made. And I think it's so easy to lose sight of the fact that just because we enjoy being able to access fuels, admittedly, at an inflated price, somebody else was paying a much higher price somewhere else.
And there is a risk, which I forgot to mention there, which is, you know, we've had the rationing by price thing, and were the conflict to reignite and re-escalate, we are getting close to the sort of limits of the buffers that were in the system that have allowed things to continue with something like business as usual for OECD nations, at least in the last months. If that were to tip over into a situation where outright shortages became much wider spread, then what we would see is rationing not by price, but by military might and diplomatic wrangling. And New Zealand's position that we've taken of basically not aligning with our Asian neighbours and putting in place emergency management activities that are specifically aimed to bring down the total level of consumption, we could easily be seen diplomatically as a laggard and not a team player, and that could affect our ability to access fuel in those sorts of scenarios.
I could imagine that, and I think you've described that in some of your posts on your Substack, haven't you? Nathan, I'd like to go from there into the question of energy transition. We all know the term, the energy transition. Public discussion of decarbonizing society almost always focuses on the transition to renewables, to wind, solar, hydro, etc., while maintaining much of the lifestyles we're used to, but just drawing on different energy sources. How realistic is this as a way to plan a pathway to an enduring low carbon future, which is where we've got to get to? And yes, do you have in mind any policy settings you might like to advocate to make it as effective a transition as possible?
So on the issue of how realistic this is, we have to go back to that biophysical constraint on liquid fuel supply constraining future economic pathways globally. And it's fair to say that, you know, we can transition to a much higher percentage of renewables in the next, say, 5 to 10 years in New Zealand, and we should do so. You know, I've been supportive of, for example, the public education that organisations like Rewiring Aotearoa, I'm not sure there are any other organisations like Rewiring Aotearoa, have been doing to push forward the idea of electrifying everything. I don't fully agree with that as the end point for a number of reasons, but I do think that it's very important not to get distracted by the fact that when you think about what we can do now, what we have agency to do, we have to think about technologies that are proven, economic, and in the marketplace now at scale. And really, solar and batteries and electrification of energies, and particularly solar and batteries on rooftops rather than great big out-of-town grid-tied solar farms, is I think, the sweet spot. Because in the event that I'm right in terms of where the liquid fuel situation leads us in the future, which is a pathway to a society that moves things around a lot less, both people and goods and goods, then actually what we see there is that having distributed energy resources, DERs, is a much better match to the demands, and it also protects against a number of other potential crises that we face, such as the AF8 risk on the South Island, the Hikarani fault on the North Island. Yes. We've been told recently about a fault they've just discovered south of the Bombay Hills in Auckland. You know, where you live in the Shaky Isle, the sorts of disruption to large-scale grid infrastructure that are possible as a result of those types of risks and the management of that implies to me, a distributed energy system with nodes that can operate independent of the grid as the default is absolutely a policy that should be set in stone. And that goes right down to, you know, removing the possibility of installing grid-tied inverters for home solar power systems, because you should always have a hybrid system so that you can then in future or on day one, if you can afford it, install a battery as well to allow you to have a little bit of independence from grid supply.
You're talking to someone, Nathan, who put in photovoltaics on my roof 12 years ago at a
Fantastic.
time when you couldn't easily get a hybrid inverter, and I've just paid big dollars to change to a hybrid inverter for exactly the reason you say.
Yeah.
So, yes, I agree with you.
I mean, there are other policy settings as well. The other one that I've written a bit about through the Wise Response Society in association with the guys in the degrowth Aotearoa grouping as well is around tradable energy quotas. And that's basically a way of rationing, and let's be honest, that's what will be required in the future if I'm right and we have a hard constraint on available supply, then we'll have to ration what we can get and make sure that it's going to the highest use for society as a whole and not just to whoever can afford to pay the most for it. I don't think that should be a controversial statement, although I'm sure there are people who would very much see it as one. Basically, tradable energy quotas is the idea that you set a national budget for energy in this can be simplistically just liquid fuels, or it could be a more sophisticated version that brings in other types of energy as well. This was created, the proposal for tradable energy quotas was created back in the early 2000s by David Fleming, who is a fantastic, now unfortunately deceased, heterodox economist based in the UK, founder of the New Economics Foundation, and he wrote a book called Lean Logic, a Dictionary of Environmental Manners, which is available at leanlogic.online and is a fantastic...
Thank you. I've never heard of that. That's great.
It's an incredible resource. One of his favorite quotes, of his is around localism, which relates to that idea of distributed energy resources, where he says, localization stands at best at the limits of the practical possibility. However, it has the decisive argument in its favor. There will be no alternative.
That's quite a telling comment, isn't it?
Yeah. So anyway, but tradable energy quotas, going back to that, apologies for that little rabbit trail, he is the idea of rationing by volume the available energy supply that we have, allocating around about 60% of it to domestic users on a per capita basis, and then putting the rest into a weekly auction where commercial and industrial users can bid for the remaining resource through a market mechanism. Now, the reason I think this is a good idea is that the market sets the price, so the market can actually see what the value of that fuel is. And then for the domestic users who are allocated their individual quota, they get to choose whether they use that quota themselves directly, or if they're frugal for any number of reasons and can use less than they're allocated, they can sell the rest to the commercial auction, and therefore, make the rest available through that commercial auction to other users who can bid for it, and they receive both the benefits of the efficiencies that they've achieved in order to be frugal, and also some financial income as a result of being able to trade their quota in that marketplace. And you know, we've heard about the fantastic fortunes that those who've had fisheries quota have made over recent times. This is kind of a similar a mechanism, but for energy, and I think it would be something that would have a rebalancing effect on some of the inequalities that we're seeing developing in New Zealand. It's one of a number of different ways of approaching it, obviously, but I think it deserves serious consideration. On the wiseresponse.substack.com website, we've put out a few articles on tradable energy quotas, and we're hoping to do a bit more in that space going forwards. It really is a policy for our times, we believe, and it's something that we should be seriously considering.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm for one going to have a look at those. I Christina Hood, in my interview with her the other day, was saying that she sees electricity as being potentially one of the election topics that's going to be talked about.
Yes.
I hope it will be, because I think it's a lot more than just flicking a light on. It's about well-being and about equity within the whole energy system and so on. Can I just dial back a little bit? I live in Nelson, where Mike Ward used to be a Green MP, and Mike is a great advocate for carbon quotas. You give everybody so much carbon a year and then they can trade it. I see that as a problem, that it's disconnected from an existing good pricing mechanism. But just going back to your quota system, how do you see it? Is it vulnerable to being gamed, in rather the way that the ETS has been gamed, where people have bought cheap carbon and then banked it and then don't make the system work the way it was intended after that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the ETS, as it was originally conceived, is a cap and trade policy, right? And you should have a descending cap on the total amount that's traded. Unfortunately, and it's pretty obvious to me, when you're relying on the market to set a price and then you get a whole ecosystem of traders who are interested in profiting off the trade of that commodity, there is no incentive to reduce the amount traded. In fact, quite the opposite. And the reality is that alongside the sorts of policy like tradable energy quotas as an alternative to the ETS, we have to recognize that the reason that the ETS has failed is not because a cap and trade policy couldn't succeed on, you know, or carbon quote, you know, some sort of carbon quota, but because the policy, as it was originally conceived of and intended, has been diluted and corrupted by moneyed interests successfully lobbying successive governments through a variety of policy changes that have ultimately led to a system that is fundamentally failing us at this point, and leading to significant liabilities in terms of both our international obligations and, you know, what was the news this last couple of weeks, our potential liabilities as a result of their failures are something in the region of $5 billion. I mean,
they're well up in the billions, yes.
Yeah. I mean, this is a massive amount of money for a country like New Zealand. You know, I mean, $5 billion in, again, round numbers, is roughly $1,000 for everyone in the country, right? And so that's a lot of money. And that could easily be changed if we had the political will. I think the key there, if I'm totally honest, as far as I can tell, is getting money out of politics, getting lobbying to be a regulated, completely transparent, live streamed on, you know, the internet type activity. And I know that still obviously leaves room for gaming through backdoor conversations and so on. But, you know, this recent debacle with the interference of the current government in the Mike Smith climate policy case has just an incredible example of the depth and the
clout,
the clout that these large organizations have. And, you know, it's I don't think it's anyone's fault. I mean, you know, you can go around waving fingers and so on, but I prefer to step back and look at the systems. And as I say, systemically, it's pretty clear in my mind what the issues are, and that there are things that we can do to fix this and to actually leave ourselves and our children and grandchildren a system that actually does what we know it needs to do based on what the science is telling us around climate change and, planetary boundaries and resource depletion. These are all, you know, the two sides of the same pair of scissors, if you like. We're going to get cut by wood.
Yeah. So coming back to the tradable energy quota, the key to that, and I framed the question, how does it not fall into the same trap that the ETS did, which we were just talking about it. Do you see some key safeguards that a government or successive governments need to be able to buy into to keep it as a reducing lid system rather than one that's sort of falls on its face?
I'll be honest, I don't think my thinking has developed far enough that I can really give that question a good response at this point, Lindsay. I mean, you know, it's something that clearly there are ways to game any system, and you know, with the best will in the world, there'll always be players who are looking to subvert what they see as an unjust or unfair system because it impinges on their ability to do whatever the hell they like and consequences be damned, right? Which is the sort of libertarian approach, right? And so that sort of thing will always be there. And I think, you know, what we have to recognize is the failure of the current system and the need for an alternative. And I'm open to other suggestions. I've been looking at this for a long time now, and tradable energy quotas I keep coming back to because it is a relatively simple policy once you get your head around it. One of the reactions that I've had from people to it is, oh, that sounds really complex and difficult to administer. And so we put together a bit of an article on how it would be relatively simple to use to set up, and you know, sort of at the start of this energy crisis, we said, you know, well, you could theoretically put something in place in about 8 weeks if you had the political will, you know. I mean, that may be a little bit optimistic, but it was, you know, to try and make the point that actually it's a novel concept, and as with all novel concepts, you know, people take time to get their head around them. And I'm really just advocating that people take time to actually have a look at tradable energy quotas as an alternative, because once you get your head around the concept, it's surprisingly elegant, and I could see it being a very effective policy that actually made some real change in terms of it allowed people to see a economic incentive that they didn't have to go and apply for loans or grants or, you know, all those sorts of things. Yeah. It's just right there in the mechanism, and it's linked to something that most people use every day. I do think there's a real potential benefit from a policy like that. It does simplify things overall, and alongside things like land value tax and so on, and potentially even things like demurrage currency, things that support the velocity of money. Again, you know, in economic contraction, people's mindset, the psychology shifts from you know, thinking in expansionary terms and positive terms to being more protectionist and thinking about saving money and not spending it. So you see massive precipitous drops in discretionary spending, as I'm sure we've seen in this recent crisis. You have to understand all of these things systemically and understand the mechanisms that can sit alongside each other. So, you know, tradable energy quotas, a simplified land value tax system, and some sort of currency which effectively depreciates over time to encourage spending rather than saving, would all work in conjunction to provide for a much different economics, financial dynamic that would support energy efficiency activities and the sorts of energy transition things that we've been talking about.
I feel a giant rabbit hole yawning out in front of us here.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's another big discussion. Before we finally leave this particular topic, early on,
yes,
you talked about David Fleming's book, and you also talked about dividing the energy quota between 60% to domestic, which was, I think, a quota that was just put there as a number, and here's your energy. And then the other 40% was auctioned in a across the commercial sector. Check the 60 to 40% ratios there? How do they come about? And are they sort of, can we have confidence in them doing the job?
So honestly, that was something that was just in the literature around tradable energy quotas from the previous work that was done. This was actually considered in detail back at the end of the 2000s by the UK Parliament, and there was a large report that was written by the UK government on the potential for it. The outcome was basically, yes, it has a lot of potential, but it's novel and we don't know how to message this to people and so on. But these... you know, on the face of it, that 60 to 40% should reflect the proportion of fuel use across those two very broad categories, you know, private households and commercial and industrial entities, in terms of the amount of fuel that they use, but also weighted in my mind towards the private sector a little bit, to both encourage the flow of money back to that sector from the commercial sector through that auctions mechanism that was discussed.
Thank you for that insight. I want to go into possibly a little bit of controversial field, to go into the area of what we might not be being told, because there's a recurring sense that the government are at best being euphemistic and at worst downright dishonest about the realities of the climate crisis. And for example, Professor Jonathan Boston opened this series for us, and in the very first interview, he urged politicians to tell the truth about the climate crisis. And you may know as well as I do that early this year, the UK's National Security Assessment on Global Ecosystems report, which was a pretty dire report, was actually withheld by their government until an Official Information Act request got it prized out of the system. How well do you feel our government is keeping us citizens informed on the big energy and climate issues that cross your desk, Nathan?
I think they're doing an abysmal job in a general sense, unfortunately. And I think that the reality is that the Westminster system of government is at fault here. You know, the people who rise to the decision-making positions within the executive branch of government actually don't have the technical chops to be able to hear the messages from the scientists and engineers and so on in society who are trying to communicate around these issues. And the way that, in particular, urgency has been used by successive governments over the last 15 years that I've been in New Zealand has fundamentally undermined the ability of those technocrats, if you like, the people in the bureaucracy who are holders of the you could call them technical subject matter experts within the various ministries and so on, and I know quite a few of them. They really, when I speak to them, they just express despair and frustration at what's been going on. And it is a really dire situation. There is another point, and it goes back to that my sort of wanting to focus on systems thinking in this interview a bit, which is that the climate message as a whole has, you know, been under sustained attack by various sort of lobbying interests internationally, and it's pretty clear to me that that has been quite an effective policy from their perspective, but it simplifies and muddies the water. And I'd like to simplify it as far as I can from that systems thinking perspective by saying, making two broad statements. One is that the IPCC process and the models that have been built are, like all models, I think it's Gavin Schmidt from NASA who's got that famous quote that all models are wrong, some are useful. the reality is that those models are wrong in quite an important way, which is that they don't include proper consideration of positive feedback loops in climate systems, not to the extent that those systems are, the changes that they're driving are apparent in the data in recent years. I think Jim Hansen is one of the few climate scientists out there really sounding the alarm properly on that and saying, you know, we are already past 1.5 degrees and, you know, we may well be at 1.7 in the next couple of years. Obviously, there's this, that sort of time-weighted series that's supposed to, you know, say retrospectively move past that threshold, but that's no use in terms of framing up policy of that's commensurate with the urgency of that situation. On the one hand, those models underestimate the positive feedbacks. And then the other side of that is that they have overestimated how much carbon could be emitted. And we've seen that actually change in recent scenarios modeling, where RCP 8.5, which is the high emissions scenario, has been shown to be basically, you just can't emit that much carbon. It's just not a realistic pathway because of the resource depletion curves that we're on. I wonder about some of the lower RCPs below 8.5 as well. And I think that there is reasonable evidence in my mind to say that some of those may also be too high in terms of the potential for us to continue emitting carbon, not because we won't try, but because literally the diesel supply in particular and the shifts in that over time are going to lead to a reduction. And it was interesting, even last night I saw a chart showing that there has been a slowdown in the rate of emissions globally. And you can see it in the CO2 numbers measured in Hawaii at Mauna Loa, where they're saying, you know, we can see this pause and, like, you know, there is something going on here.
Is the Strait of Hormuz impact coming through?
I don't know. I don't think it is. And I think this is the thing, is that, you know, those sorts of trends and the impacts of those are measured on timeframes that, you know, the last few months wouldn't have led to a measurable drop, even if it dropped to zero, probably, you know, just because of the dynamics of the system. So, yeah, I think this is a larger, bigger scale trend that's going on. There's another way to look at this, and I think this is something that might be more accessible to your readers. We have this ongoing conversation in New Zealand, but also in all OECD nations, and in fact, globally, when you start to read around, about why is it that productivity isn't increasing? You know, why aren't we doing more? And there are a couple of really basic things that people just seem to ignore consistently. One is diminishing returns, the law of diminishing returns, and specifically diminishing returns on energy efficiency and things like that. Now, that is not to say that there isn't some massive low-hanging fruit out there in terms of energy efficiency, because there absolutely is. New Zealand, in terms of the, I think it's specifically diesel inputs per dollar of GDP, is one of the worst countries in the world. You know, our efficiency there is
right,
absolutely abysmal. And so we could do massive things easily and quickly that would radically change our requirement, you know, our climate liabilities and our risk profile in that regard.
If I can dial back to that thing where you said there's a radical change we could do to improve our diesel consumption per dollar of GDP.
Yeah.
Are you able to give a sort of a hint as to what sort of things might bring that about?
I mean, the big thing is electrification of logistics. So, you know, both coastal shipping, potentially with wind-assisted things, is volumetrically far more efficient than road. And then also rail is also volumetrically far more efficient than road. And we have both of those options available to us. And again, because of the political ideology and the lack of technical background in the decision makers in Parliament, we just haven't seized the opportunities that have been repeatedly put in front of successive governments around those types of mode shifts.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. We might come back to that another time. Mm-hmm. So I realize that we don't have very much longer to go, Nathan, before
sure.
I have to let you get on to your next appointment. I've got quite a few things I could ask you. There's always more questions than answers. First of all, though, I'd like to jump into the Wise Response organization that you chair. Please tell listeners a little bit about what the organization is, give us a snapshot, and also what it means for the climate policy space, and also if any listeners attempted to get involved, how might they actually engage with Wise Response?
So Wise Response was set up back in around 2012, 2013 by Sir Alan Mark. He was the first chair of the organization. And at the time, the patron was Sir Geoffrey Palmer. And we had a launch event in Dunedin where we presented a petition to governments basically saying that we needed to have some sort of formal risk assessment process and, you know, something that actually is effectively a systems thinking approach to policy making. Internally, we've talked a lot about, you know, things like the Commission for the Future that was disbanded back in the early 80s that really, you know, because it started telling government things they didn't want to hear. And I mean, this goes back to that systemic problem, right? You know, don't shoot the messenger. You know, the message is what the message is as dictated by the science as it's understood. And we can't just keep burying our head in the sand. So really, Wise Response, its core message and its the question it leads with is, as demand for growth exceeds Earth's physical limits, causing unprecedented risks, what knowledge and actions do we need to secure New Zealand's future well-being? And so we've used that as really, I guess, our driving principle. And the activities we've undertaken in the last 12-13 years, I've been a committee member for about 12 years and I'm the current chair for the last year or so, is to make some very detailed technical submissions on government consultations at the national level. Because the majority of the commissioners are Otago-based, our former secretary, Dougal McTavish, has spent quite a bit of time engaging with the Otago Regional Council around things like integrated land management and so on as a policy response at the local level. And, you know, we feel we've been trying to help shape that down there. Within my own capabilities, do some similar activities in Southland. We as an organisation have really been just trying to, I guess, engage with that layer of governance, both at the national and regional levels, to try and bring some systems thinking, some sort of ecologically grounded planetary boundaries and resource depletion aware thinking into the consultation processes, and with limited success. You know, let's be honest about it. You know, as I said, you know, the dynamics of our systems of governance at the moment are such that we have had an uphill battle that we've faced, and you know we've made submissions on things like the settings of the NDCs for our IPCC commitments and so on.
Just quickly for listeners, NDC is nationally determined contribution, and that's us, our bid to the IPCC on how much we will reduce our emissions, among other things.
Yeah. And I think that was somewhere about 2016, 2017, somewhere around then. And looking back on that document, I looked at it the other day for another purpose. I think I feel fairly vindicated that we were sort of on the money in terms of the things we did. So we've got a large body of evidence actually on our website in the form of PDFs of those submissions. And it's quite nice to be able to sort of point people to that and say, you know, particularly your listeners who are interested in climate change, just type climate change into the search on the website, and you know you'll come up with some very interesting material from a wide variety of leading thinkers from New Zealand society whose voices we feel need amplification because they really just haven't been heard enough.
Right, thank you. So just recap the website, that if people want to get on the website.
Yeah, it's wiseresponse.org.nz is our main website. And as I say, we've recently started up a wiseresponse.substack.com site as well, which there's, you know, cross-linked between the two sites really to help get our articles out there and make them a bit more discoverable via that ecosystem.
And I'm guessing that if there were listeners that thought, oh, I wouldn't mind getting involved or making contact with them, the website gives them avenues for that.
It does. I mean, you know, particularly, you know, in a forum like this, I would say, by all means, listeners, just contact me directly. You know, my email address is nathan@schema.nz, S-C-H-E-M-A.nz. And I'd be happy to pass your details on to the to the secretary and to link you into our mailing list and keep you up to date with the things that are going on there.
Brilliant. Well, that's a lovely offer. And I think that might be where we call it quits for today, Nathan. We've already peered down some rabbit holes we might go down another time. Thank you. Thank you so much. I've got so much out of our discussion. I'm really grateful for the time you've made available to us. So thank you very much.
That's a pleasure.
Well, there's another fascinating interview with a guest I would have been pleased to talk with for hours. I'm sure we'll have Nathan back sometime. Next week, we have Simon Miller, who's the Executive Director of Green Business Organization Pure Advantage and has a great background in regenerative agriculture, rootlooking Papatua Nuku, and other initiatives. Following that will be well-known financial analyst and economist Shamabile Yacob. If you want to access the schedule for the whole series of interviews, then do go on my firm's website, resilience.co.nz, and navigate to the Front Footing the Future page. And on that note, I do hope I have your company again for the next interviews. And as always, kia kaha for the climate.